Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Can billionaire philanthropists change the world? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Bill and Melinda Gates, the Rockefeller Foundation, and George Soros are all focused on hunger and poverty in Africa. Tonight, is it a golden age of philanthropy or a tournament of billionaires? We'll hear that some Africans fear that external interference can overwhelm poor countries with technologies they're not prepared for. What are the rules for turning good intentions into positive outcomes? On Reporter's Notebook, Pope Benedict, Islam, and Holy War. First, here's the news. Herman Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. George Soros is giving $50 million to what's called the Millennium Promise. Two foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates and Rockefeller, have joined forces to fight poverty in Africa by ending hunger. But some Africans are solving problems without Western help, which can sometimes mean interference. One of those is Glivens Chinkuntha, executive director of the Freedom Gardens in Doha, Malawi. Welcome.
Most welcome.
You've made a great deal of a name for yourself by using techniques in the growing of food that don't require any kind of help from the outside. What's your view of the Rockefeller and Gates projects and others, and do you think that Africa will be helped by them?
Yes. We're actually now close to 24 years of agricultural experience, farming experience in the communities. So what we did from the beginning was introduce very simple, humble, low external input methods of raising food at local level. So within a few years of our launching, we decided to forsake altogether industrial fertilizers and started putting together practices that would rely on conservation farming, which is reliant on proper management of biomass and other organic matter, and then decided to use the water resource that we have all around us much more efficiently than everybody else does. So we introduced low-cost irrigation systems, which everybody else now is adopting within the community, to a point where, in fact, the demand for that, for those kinds of technologies and that kind of food productivity approaches is getting greater, and we're having less and less water now to satisfy everybody's demand. So, yes, if you have heard that, the main reason is I myself decided to quit urban work to join the communities in order to start up something with them and see if we could not succeed without external interference. And I actually decided to condescend down myself. So I had to pick up the hole. I had to work together with everybody else because I had to show the way for the people to copy.
When you say that you're able to do this without external interference, let me ask you this. Do you think that Western money always comes with strings? Does it mean interference? Or would you expect to get help from Western countries for the kinds of things that you're doing?
Up to a certain point, I wouldn't need anybody's support. For example, I think the problem that we have in Africa is when you want to get into enterprise, you want to start big. So because you're planning to start big, then you feel you don't have sufficient resources to get on. So what the philosophy we're following here is start small with the resources that you have. Start as you are and where you are. But having started that way, then definitely you don't want any external complications. So you go ahead, start small, start with the little thing that you have, start with the local resources, start with the natural resources around you, and mobilize the people around you who will rally behind you along those lines. So having started small, from the first products that you raise from your small gardens and you sell, the principle is consume a smaller percentage and plow back a larger percentage. So it is based on hard work, perseverance, and austerity.
What do you mean by external complications?
External complications. I'll pick up one particular complication. Seemingly, this is supposed to be a facilitation. This is the extension, for example. Our extension services have all been based on industrial technology extension. And the industrial technologies are still proving, and will for a long time remain too costly for small-scale farmers to adopt. Not only too costly, but they are too technically or intellectually advanced for us to absorb straight away. So this is where I saw rather than facilitate extension service as we know it, conventional extension service, brought in messages that didn't get far enough into farmers' perceptions. And then what then? They went back and said, we have been there, the farmers have listened to us, they are paying attention, they are picking up the technologies, when farmers didn't pick up any technology at all. So immediately they give them their backs, farmers revert to their old practices of shifting cultivation, do it as you know, so that you can survive.
Well, thank you very much, Glevens Chinkuntha, again, Executive Director of the Freedom Gardens in Doha, Malawi. We've heard about external interference, one of the possible downsides of the best of intentions. What about the role of philanthropy in ending African poverty? Paul Shervish is Director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
You have been quoted as saying that you think this is the beginning of a new golden age in philanthropy. What do you mean?
What I mean is that there are several vectors, if you will, like in physics, that are in play, forces. They're not always pointed in the same direction, and they don't all have the same magnitude. But cumulatively, these vectors are pointing to a set of circumstances that are going to lead to a greater quantity of philanthropy and a greater quality. One of them, of these factors, is that wealth holders are increasingly no longer resisting or simply responding to strong-arm invitations to give, but are actually seeking out ways to be philanthropically involved in their communities and across the world. Second vector is that they're seeking to do so entrepreneurially. Third is that they have much more money at a younger age than any other group in history. Fourth, they see philanthropy as a way of fulfilling themselves and bringing happiness to themselves and others simultaneously. And by happiness, I mean effectiveness and significance.
Talking with Paul Shervish, the Director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. Well, what about what we just heard from Glevens Chinkuntha in Malawi, that he thinks that external support means external complications of the sort that he outlined a moment ago, a technology that's too costly, too advanced, too difficult for the people who are supposed to receive its benefits to deal with. And he explained how he's been able, using only the resources now available in Malawi, to make enormous improvements on the agricultural situation there.
Well, this is always what's a concern. Any intervention, and I have written about this and are well aware of this, is Janus-based. That is, it has the great potential to produce the results that are positive and actually meet people's true needs. That's my definition of good philanthropy, is when you meet the true needs of others. Now, we can always debate about what those true needs are, but it's always the right question. And what he's pointing out is that in that particular instance, with that particular intervention, the true needs that were there were not met properly. That is, there was some failure of competence by those providing, certainly out of goodwill, the intervention. And this is what I call the dialectic of care and failure that is present in any intervention, whether it's an intervention with our children, whether it's an intervention in our workplace, or whether it's an intervention on a large scale philanthropically. All interventions can be like fire or like electricity. They can produce great results, or when done non-thoughtfully, non-carefully, can produce unintended consequences and even disastrous ones.
Paul Shervish again at Boston College. William Easterly is professor of economics at New York University. He's author of The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. He's also a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development, and he has spent 16 years as a research economist at the World Bank. Professor Easterly, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You're the one who came up with the phrase tournament of billionaires to describe what's going on here with all of these people that Mr. Shervish or Professor Shervish is talking about. You're a skeptic about those.
I think we need to be skeptical because we need to realize that the way these guys made their money was much easier than the way that they're spending it. It's much, much easier to make money in an advanced capitalist system like the U.S. than it is to end a really complex problem of poverty in a faraway country that you know very little or nothing about. And it's frankly kind of arrogant to think that, you know, just because someone over here is rich, that they know the solutions to someone else's problem in a very different culture who's poor.
Well, now, we just heard that referred to as the dialectic of I think it was care and failure, if I made the appropriate note here. So always you have that problem, but is it possible that we are now seeing a new age where people are not only younger and have more money than those in the past, but are willing to get directly involved and actually find the solutions to the problems that they're trying to deal with?
Well, certainly there are some positive signs here. You know, it's certainly great that the attention is being focused on the poor of the world as opposed to, you know, symphony orchestras for rich people. That's great. I have nothing against that. And there are some positive developments in what we've seen so far. You know, the Gates Foundation, I think, if you have to declare a first round winner in the tournament of billionaires, I think Mr. Gates has clearly won the billionaire IQ contest over Mr. Soros, because the new Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation initiative, is very pragmatic and open ended about just trying to find things that work on the ground to improve African agriculture and hopefully find a new green revolution. Whereas what Mr. Soros is proposing to back is frankly rather silly. It's a kind of Potemkin village that are being set up around Africa to try to end poverty within sort of one little miniature village utopia at a time, without realizing that poverty is really a deep social, institutional, political problem that depends on the whole society and can't be ended in isolation in one village. I'm kind of surprised that Mr. Soros went for that. I guess it just shows you can get rich in our society without understanding how capitalism really works.
This is the Millennium Villages project that he is supporting. We don't have anybody specifically on the program to defend the Millennium Villages. We'll just have to stipulate that there is another view of that. Perhaps we'll be able to hear from somebody who does support them on another program. I want to raise another issue, Paul Shervish, with you again at the Center for Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. Google as I understand it, is entrepreneurial in another sense from the one that you have mentioned and is thinking in terms of making profit on philanthropy. How does that work?
Well, actually, the way they've divided up their charitable arm, Google.org, is that it isn't really a philanthropic venture in the legal sense. The Google Foundation is, but the money that they have transferred across from the company over to the philanthropic side has a for-profit wing that is going to attempt to produce goods and services that will be produced with a business model, but willing to take lower bottom-line financial returns in the hope of gaining greater social returns. And so they're not alone in trying to do this. There are several drugs being developed by angel investors that are working through a nonprofit mechanism, not ultimately hoping to make profit or substantial profit, but attempting to run a business that has the ability to survive and to have the discipline and the loans and so on of a business, but at the same time to produce results that are measured as the bottom line that are both social benefits as well as financial benefits. And Google is doing this within an organization, within the company. And as far as I know, they're really the first company to say that as part of our business proposition, we're going to have areas that are going to work at work for and be satisfied with below market profits in order to obtain some positive social good as well.
William Easterly, we're very close to running out of time on this part of our program, but I'm interested in your take on this idea. Is this a new model for philanthropy that might, in fact, attract more investors, might, in fact, do social good as well as earning, if lower financial returns, still some financial returns?
Well, at this point, it's an experiment, so it's too soon to tell. But it's a promising experiment because what's been so lacking in so much of official aid is any bottom line at all. Where do you have any mechanism to let you know whether the customers, who are the world's poor, are satisfied after the aid project is over? And in official aid, the answer has always been no. There has been no bottom line. It's just been pushing the money out the door without really knowing if the poor are really getting the money or not. And with more of a bottom line in for-profit philanthropy, maybe there's some hope of fixing that problem.
We're going to leave it at that. I want to thank you both for being with us. William Easterly at New York University, author of The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Effort to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good, and Paul Shervish, director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. Thanks again to both of you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Sure enough.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You can find current and past editions of this program at kcrw.com. Click on KCRW On Demand to search the Which Way LA archives. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. Yesterday at a German university, Pope Benedict XVI quoted these words from a 14th century Christian emperor. "Show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman, such as his command to spread by the sword the faith he preached." That has caused outrage throughout the Muslim world and may be a problem for the Pope's November visit to Turkey. Semih İdiz is columnist at Milliyet, one of Turkey's major newspapers. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been very badly taken by Muslims all over the world. Tell us what the reaction has been in Turkey, where the Pope is planning a visit this coming November.
Well, the initial reaction was that the head of the Religious Affairs Directorate made a statement, and it was rather a striking statement. It wasn't diplomatic in tone, which was rather interesting because he is actually an officer of the state, in effect. So he was expressing an anger, I suppose, that is also being supported by the state and the government. And he basically is demanding some kind of an apology from the Pope, and this has led some to speculate that the Pope's visit may be called off in November. I haven't anything today to suggest that that is the case. In fact, I think that both sides will watch the developments very carefully to see how plays out over the next few weeks before they come to such a decision. But I must say that at any rate, when the Pope does visit Turkey in November, I think it has already been tainted, in fact, and we can expect protests and scenes during his visit. So, in fact, the waters have been sullied, so to speak.
Some of the non-diplomatic language you referred to from that officer in the ruling party, the Justice and Development Party, was that the Pope will go down in history in the same category as Hitler and Mussolini, and that he's trying to revive the spirit of the Crusades. That's pretty inflammatory language right there.
Yeah, it is, in fact. But you see, the whole background to this is the notion that the Pope is suggesting here through a Byzantine emperor of a few centuries back that, you know, Islam is being spread by the sword. And in fact, this part of the world has memories when Christianity was spread by the sword, when one of the Pope's predecessors, Urban II, in 1095, or more or less ordered the First Crusade. So, in fact, this notion of spreading religion by the sword cuts both ways in this part of the world, and I think this is part of why there is so much sensitivity.
We're talking with Sami Adiz, who's columnist at Milliyet, one of the major newspapers in Turkey. What about security issues? Apparently, at the Vatican today, there's been some discussion about whether the Pope is going to be completely safe in Turkey, or for that matter, wherever he goes. Do you think that might be a problem?
I don't think security would be any problem in Turkey. I can't speak for other countries. You know, and when he does come, not if he does come, but when he does come, we're still assuming that he's going to come. You can be assured that security will be maximum. So I don't think there's a risk on that score.
What about Turkey itself, and what's the number and proportion of the population that's Catholic Christian as opposed to Islamic or secular?
Oh, I mean, the proportions are very striking in Turkey. Turkey is a 99% Muslim country, and the majority of the Muslims in Turkey are Sunnis, but we do also have Alevis, who are a sect or an offshoot of the Shiites, but a much more moderate, a very different kind of philosophy. So, in fact, Turkey is a Muslim country in that respect, and the Christian element is you know, almost negligible.
So what then is thought to be the purpose and the hoped-for outcome of the Pope's visit?
Well, he is coming first within the context of intercivilizational amity, so to speak. And this is why his remarks were received with some surprise, because this is the kind of atmosphere that he was said to be coming to Turkey with. And he also, during his visit to Turkey, has a meeting with the patriarch, the Greek Orthodox patriarch in Istanbul, which, of course, is a different agenda in the sense that it's trying to establish bridges between the Eastern and Western churches. So he has a twofold aim during that visit, and so far that seems to be still on track. But, of course, as I say, we have to see how things play out over the next few days.
Well, that's what is being said in the Vatican, that, in fact, the Pope has been misunderstood and that, in fact, what he was trying to do was encourage a dialogue between the religions. Do you think that Muslims in Turkey will hear that and will be willing to see that he meant something different from the way it was interpreted, or are they going to continue to demand an apology?
I think that you will find elements that will demand an apology, of course. But I think there will also be other more sober elements who will realize that I think even the Pope himself realizes that there was some kind of a massive political gaffe here. And therefore, the diplomacy of the Vatican will have to come to play, and we'll see how that works. I think the attempt to try and explain today was probably a positive move. But the remarks of the Pope seem to suggest something rather strong. So I think those who are offended by this will expect a little more.
Given the strong language from the ruling party, what if the Pope demands an apology for that? I don't suppose he will. But again, hasn't that sort of escalated the situation to say that he's going down and in history like Hitler and Mussolini?
Well, first of all, let me say that the remark you quoted comes from a deputy from within the party, which is a majority party, and it has quite a large number of members. So in that sense, I don't know if he's speaking on behalf of the party. I think the Prime Minister would be much more cautious in this respect, and he will, of course, say it's unacceptable and all that, but I don't think he'll go for inflammatory language. So I don't think that you should read too much into the remarks of one deputy in the sense that, you know, it may not be binding as far as the party's view is concerned.
Well, once again, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Semih Adiz, columnist at Milliyet, one of the major newspapers in Turkey. The producers of Which Way LA are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Dan Konecki, and Vanessa Romo. Our managing producers, Karen Radziner. Technical director is Mike Newport. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.